After the Apocalypse by Maureen F. McHugh. Jane puts out the sleeping bags in the backyard of the empty house by the tool shed. She has a lock and hasp and an old hand drill that they can use to lock the tool shed from the inside. But it's too hot to sleep in there, and there haven't been many people on the road. Better to sleep outside. Franny has been talking a mile a minute. Usually, by the end of the day, she is tired from walking. They both are. And quiet. But this afternoon, she's gotten on the subject of her friend Samantha. She's musing on if Samantha has left town like they did. They're probably still there, because they had a really nice house in, like, a low-crime area, and Samantha's father has a really good job. When you have money like that, maybe you can totally afford a security system or something. Their house has 5 bedrooms, and the basement isn't a basement. It's a living room, because the house is kind of on a little hill, and although the front of the basement is underground, you can walk right out the back. Jane says, "That sounds nice." You could see a horse farm behind them. People around them were rich, but not, like, on TV rich, exactly. Jane puts her hands on her hips and looks down the line of backyards. "Do you think there's anything in there?" Franny asks, meaning the house, a 60s suburban ranch. Franny is 13, and empty houses frighten her. But she doesn't like to be left alone, either. What she wants is for Jane to say that they can eat one of the tuna pouches. "Come on, Franny. We're going to run out of tuna long before we get to Canada." "I know," Franny says sullenly. "You can stay here." "No, I'll go with you." God, sometimes Jane would do anything to get 5 minutes away from Franny. She loves her daughter, really, but Jesus. "Come on then," Jane says. There is an old square concrete patio and a sliding glass door. The door is dirty. Jane cups her hand to shade her eyes and looks inside. It's dark and hard to see. No power, of course. Hasn't been power in any of the places they've passed through in more than 2 months. Air conditioning, and a bed with a mattress and box springs. What Jane wouldn't give for air conditioning and a bed. Clean sheets. The neighborhood seems like a good one. Unless they find a big group to camp with, Jane gets them off the freeway at the end of the day. There was fighting in the neighborhood, and at the end of the street, several houses are burned out. Then there are lots of houses with windows smashed out. But the fighting petered out. Some of the houses are still lived in. This house had all its windows intact, but the garage door was standing open, and the garage was empty except for dead leaves. Electronic garage door. The owners pulled out and left and didn't bother to close the door behind them. Seemed to Jane that the overgrown backyard with its tool shed would be a good place to sleep. Jane can see her silhouette in the dirty glass, and her hair is a snarled, curly, tangled rat's nest. She runs her fingers through it, and they snag. She'll look for a scarf or something inside. She grabs the handle and yanks up, hard, trying to get the old slider off track. It takes a couple of tries, but she's had a lot of practice in the last few months. Inside, the house is trashed. The kitchen has been turned upside down, and silverware, utensils, drawers, broken plates, flour, and stuff are everywhere. She picks her way across, a can opener skittering under her foot with a clatter. Franny gives a little startled shriek. "Fuck," Jane says. "Don't do that." The canned food is long gone. "I'm sorry," Franny says. "It scared me." "We're gonna starve to death if we don't keep scavenging," Jane says. "I know," Franny says. "Do you know how fucking far it is to Canada? I can't help it if it startled me." Maybe if she were a better cook, she'd be able to scrape up the flour and make something. But it's all mixed in dirt and stuff. And every time she's tried to cook something over an open fire, it's either been raw or black or, most often, both. Blackened on the outside and raw on the inside. Jane checks all the cupboards anyway. Sometimes people keep food in different places. Once, they found one of those decorating icing tubes and wrote words on each other's hands and licked them off. Franny screams. Not a startled shriek, but a real scream. Jane whirls around, and there's a guy in the family room with a tire iron. "What are you doing here?" he yells. Jane grabs a can opener from the floor, one of those heavy jobbers, and wings it straight at his head. He's too slow to get out of the way, and it nails him in the forehead. Jane has winged a lot of things at boyfriends over the years. It's a skill. She throws a couple of more things from the floor, anything she can find, while the guy is yelling, "Fuck! Fuck!" and trying to ward off the barrage. Then she and Franny are out the back door and running. Fucking squatter! She hates squatters. If it's the homeowner, they tend to make the place more like a fortress, and you can tell not to try to go in. Squatters try to keep a low profile. Franny is in front of her, running like a rabbit, and they are out the gate and headed up the suburban street. Franny knows the drill, and at the next corner, she turns, but by then it's clear that no one's following them. "Okay," Jane pants. "Okay, stop, stop." Franny stops. She's a skinny adolescent now. She used to be chubby, but she's lean and tan with all their walking. She's wearing a pair of falling-apart pink sneakers and a tank top with oil smudges from when they had to climb over a truck tipped sideways on an overpass. She's still flat-chested. Her eyes are big in her face. Jane puts her hands on her knees and draws a shuddering breath. "Oh, we're okay," she says. It is gathering dusk in this Missouri town. In a while, streetlights will come on, unless someone has systematically shot them out. Solar power still works. "We'll wait a bit, and then go back and get our stuff when it's dark." "No!" Franny bursts into sobs. "We can't!" Jane is at her wit's end, rattled from the squatter, tired of being the strong one. "We've got to. You want to lose everything we've got? You want to die? God damn it, Franny, I can't take this anymore." "That guy's there," Franny sobs out. "We can't go back. We can't." "Your cell phone is there," Jane says. A mean dig. The cell phone doesn't work, of course. Even if they still somehow had service, if service actually exists, they haven't been anywhere with electricity to charge it in weeks. But Franny still carries it in the hope that she can get a charge and call her friends. Seventh graders are apparently surgically attached to their phones. Not that she acts even like a seventh grader anymore. The longer they are on the road, the younger Franny acts. This isn't the first time that they've run into a squatter. Squatters are cowards. The guy doesn't have a gun, and he's not going to go out after dark. Franny has no spine. Takes after her asshole of a father. Jane ran away from home and got all the way to Pasadena, California, when she was a year older than Franny. When she was 14, she was a decade older than Franny. Lived on the street for 6 weeks, begging spare change on the same route that the Rose Parade took. It had been scary, but it had been a blast as well. Taught her to stand on her own 2 feet, which Franny wasn't going to be able to do when she was 20. 30 at this rate. "You're hungry, aren't you?" Jane said, merciless. "You want to go looking in these houses for something to eat?" Jane points around them. The houses all have their front doors broken into, open like little mouths. Franny shakes her head. "Stop crying. I'm going to go check some of them out. You wait here." "Mom, don't leave me," Franny wails. Jane is still shaking from the squatter, but they need food, and they need their stuff. There is $700 sewn inside the lining of Jane's sleeping bag, and someone has to keep them alive. It's obviously going to be her. Things didn't exactly all go at once. First, there were rolling brownouts and lots of people unemployed. Jane had been making a living working at a place that sold furniture. She started as a salesperson, but she was good at helping people on what colors to buy, what things went together, but fabrics to pick for custom pieces. Eventually, they made her a service associate, a person who was kind of like an interior decorator, sort of. She had an eye. She'd grown up in a nice suburb and had seen nice things. She knew what people wanted. Her boss kept telling her a little less eye makeup would be a good idea, but people liked what she suggested and recommended her to their friends, even if her boss didn't like her eye makeup. She was thinking of starting a decorating business, although she was worried that she didn't know about some of the stuff decorators did. On TV, they were always tearing down walls and redoing fireplaces. So she put it off. Then there was the big Disney World attack where a gazillion people died because of a dirty bomb, and then the economy really tanked. She knew that business was dead and she was going to get laid off. But before that happened, someone torched the furniture place where she was working. Her boyfriend at the time was a cop, so he still had a job, even though half the city was unemployed. She and Franny were all right compared to a lot of people. She didn't like not having her own money, but she wasn't exactly having to call her mother in Pennsylvania to eat crow and offer to come home. So she sat on the balcony of their condo and smoked and looked through her old decorating magazines, and Franny watched television in the room behind her. People started showing up on the sidewalks. They had trash bags full of stuff. Sometimes they were alone. Sometimes there would be whole families. Sometimes they'd have cars and they'd sleep in them. But gas was getting to almost $10 a gallon when the gas stations could get it. Pete, the boyfriend, told her that the cops didn't even patrol much anymore because of the gas problem. More and more of the people on the sidewalk looked to be walking. "Where are they coming from?" Franny asked. "Down south. Houston, El Paso, anywhere within 100 miles of the border," Pete said. "Border's gone to shit. Mexico doesn't have food, but the drug cartels have lots of guns, and they're coming across to take what they can get. They say it's like a war zone down there."
"Why don't the police take care of them?" Franny asked.
"Well, Francisca," Pete said. He was good with Franny. Jane had to give him that. "Sometimes there are just too many of them for the police down there. And they've got kinds of guns that the police aren't allowed to have."
"What about you?" Franny asked.
"It's different up here," Pete said. "That's why we've got refugees here. Because it's safe here."
"They're not refugees," Jane said. "Refugees were like people in Africa. These were just regular people. Guys in t-shirts with the names of rock bands on them. Women sitting in the front seats of tourist station wagons, doing their hair in the rearview mirrors. Kids asleep in the back seat or running up and down the street shrieking and playing. Just people."
"Well, what do you want to call them?" Pete asked.
Then the power started going out, more and more often. Pete's shifts got longer, although he didn't always get paid. There were gunshots in the street, and Pete told Jane not to sit out on the balcony. He boarded up the French doors, and it was as if they were living in a cave. The refugees started thinning out. Jane rarely saw them leaving, but each day there were fewer and fewer of them on the sidewalk. Pete said they were headed north. Then the fire started on the east side of town. The power went out and stayed out. Pete didn't come home until the next day, and he slept a couple of hours and then went back out to work. The air tasted of smoke, not the pleasant, clean smell of wood smoke, but a garbagey smoke. Franny complained that it made her sick to her stomach. After Pete didn't come home for 4 days, it was pretty clear to Jane that he wasn't coming back. Jane put Franny in the car, packed everything she could think of that might be useful. They got about 120 miles away, far enough that the burning city was no longer visible, although the sunset was a vivid and blistering red. Then they ran out of gas, and there was no more to be had. There were rumors that there was a refugee camp for homeless outside of Toronto. So they were walking to Detroit. Franny says, "You can't leave me. You can't leave me."
"Do you want to go scavenge with me?" Jane says.
Franny sobs so hard she seems to be hyperventilating. She grabs her mother's arms, unable to do anything but hold on to her. Jane peels her off, but Franny keeps grabbing, clutching, sobbing. It's making Jane crazy. Franny's fear is contagious, and if she lets it get in her, she'll be too afraid to do anything. She can feel it deep inside her, that thing that has always threatened her to give in, to stop doing and pushing and scheming, to become like her useless, useless father, puttering around the house vacantly, bottles hidden in the garage, the basement, everywhere. "Get off me!" she screams at Franny. But Franny is sobbing and clutching. She slaps Franny. Franny throws up, precious little, water and crackers from breakfast. Then she sits down in the grass, just useless. Jane marches off into the first house. She's lucky. The garage is closed up, and there are 3 cans of soup on a shelf. One of them is cream of mushroom. But luckily, Franny liked cream of mushroom when she found it before. There are also cans of tomato paste, which she ignores, and some dried pasta, but mice have gotten into it. When she gets outside, some strange guy is standing on the sidewalk, talking to Franny, who's still sitting on the grass. For a moment, she doesn't know what to do, clutching the cans of soup against her chest. Some part of her wants to back into the house, go through the dark living room with its mauve carpeting, its shabby blue sofa, photos of school kids, and a cross-stitched flower bouquet framed on the wall, back through the little dining room with its border of country geese unchanged since the 80s, out the back door and over the fence, an easy moment to abandon the biggest mistake of her life. She'd aborted the first pregnancy, brought home from Pasadena in shame. She dug her heels in on the second. "It's my body, fuck you." Franny laughs, a little nervous and hiccupy from crying, but not really afraid. "Hey," Jane yells, "get away from my daughter." She strides across the yard, all motherhood and righteous fury. A skinny, dark-haired guy holds up his hands, palms out. "No harm, ma'am." "It's okay, Mom," Franny says. The guy is smiling. "We're just talking," he says. He's wearing a red plaid flannel shirt and t-shirt and shorts. He's scraggly, but who isn't? "Who the hell are you?" she says. "My name's Nate. I'm just heading north. Was looking for a place to camp." "He was just hanging with me until you got back," Franny says. Nate takes them to his camp, also behind a house. He gets a little fire going, enough to heat the soup. He talks about Alabama, which is where he's coming from, although he doesn't have a southern accent. He makes some excuse about being an army brat. Jane tries to size him up. He tells some story about when 2 guys stumbled on his camp north of Huntsville when he was first on the road. About how it scared the shit out of him, but about how he'd bluff them about a buddy of his who was hunting for their dinner but would have heard the racket they made and could be drawing a bead on them right now from the trees, and about how something moved in the trees, some animal rustling in the leaf litter, and they got spooked. He's looking at her, trying to impress her, but being polite, which is good with Franny listening. Franny is taken with him, hanging on his every word, flirting a little the way she does. In a year or two, Franny was going to be guy crazy. Jane knew. They didn't know anything about the woods. Just 2 guys up from Biloxi or something. Kind of guys who, you know, manage a copy store or a fast food joint or something, thinking that now that civilization is falling apart, they can be like the hero in one of their video games. He laughs. "I didn't know what was in the woods neither. I admit, I was kind of scared it was someone who was going to shoot all of us. Although it was probably just a sparrow or a squirrel or something. I'm saying stuff over my shoulder to my buddy. Like, don't shoot them or nothing. Just let them go back the way they came. She's sure he's bullshitting. But she likes that he makes it funny instead of pretending he's some sort of Rambo. He doesn't offer any of his own food, she notices. But he does offer to go with them to get their stuff. Fair trade, she thinks. He's not bad-looking in a kind of skinny way. She likes them skinny. She's tired of doing it all herself. The streetlights come on, at least some of them. Nate goes with them when they go back to get their sleeping bags and stuff. He's got a board with a bunch of nails sticking out of one end. He calls it his mace. They are quiet, but they don't try to hide. It's hard to find the stuff in the dark, but luckily, Jane hadn't really unpacked. She and Franny, who is breathing hard, get their sleeping bags and packs. It's hard to see. The backyard is a dark tangle of shadows. She assumes it's as hard to see them from inside the house. Maybe harder. Nothing happens. She hears nothing from the house, sees nothing. Although it seems as if they are all unreasonably loud gathering things up. They leave through the side gate, coming nervously to the front of the house. Nate carrying his mace and ready to strike. She and Franny with their arms full of sleeping bags. They go down the cracked driveway and out into the middle of the street. A few gutted cars still parked on either side. Then they are around the corner, and it feels safe. They are all grinning and happy, and soon putting the sleeping bags at Nate's little backyard camp made domestic, no, civilized, by the charred ash of the little fire. In the morning, she leaves Nate's bedroll and gets back to sleep next to Franny before Franny wakes up. They're walking on the freeway the next day, the three of them. They are together now, although they haven't discussed it, and Jane is relieved. People are just that much less likely to mess with the man. Overhead, three jets pass going south, visible only by their contrails. At least there are jets. American jets, she hopes. They stop for a moment while Nate goes around a bridge abutment to pee. Mom, Franny says, do you think that someone has wrecked Pete's place? I don't know, Jane says. What do you think happened to Pete? Jane is caught off guard. They left without ever explicitly discussing Pete, and Jane just thought that Franny, like her, assumed Pete was dead. I mean, Franny continues, if they didn't have gas, maybe he got stuck somewhere, or he might have gotten hurt and ended up in the hospital. Even if the hospital wasn't taking regular people, like, they take cops because they think of cops as one of their own. Franny is in her adult-to-adult mode, explaining the world to her mother. They stick together, cops and firemen and nurses. Jane isn't sure she knows what Franny is talking about. Normally, she'd tell Franny as much, but this isn't a conversation she knows how to have. Nate comes around the abutment, adjusting himself a bit, and it is understood that the subject is closed. Okay, he says. How far to Wally World? Franny giggles. Water is their biggest problem. It's hard to find, and when they do find it, either from a pond or, very rarely, from a place where it hasn't all been looted, it's heavy. Thank God Nate is pretty good at making a fire. He has 6 disposable lighters that he got from a gas station, and when they find a pond, they boil it. Somewhere Jane thinks she heard that they should boil it for 18 minutes. Basically, they just boil the heck out of it. Pond water tastes terrible, but they are always thirsty. Fanny whines. Jane is afraid that Nate will get tired of it and leave, but apparently, as long as she crawls over to his bedroll every night, he's not going to. Jane waits until she can tell Franny is asleep. It's a difficult wait. They are usually so tired it is all she can do to keep from nodding off. but she is afraid to lose Nate. At first, she liked that at night he never made a move on her. She always initiates. It made things easier all around. But now, he does this thing where she crawls over and he's pretending to be asleep. Or is asleep, the bastard, because he doesn't have to stay awake. She puts her hand on his chest and then down his pants, getting him hard and ready. She unzips his shorts, and still he doesn't do anything. She grinds on him for a while, and only then does he pull his shorts and underwear down and let her ride him until he comes. Then she climbs off him. Sometimes he might say, "Thanks, babe." Mostly, he says nothing, and she crawls back next to Franny, feeling as if she just paid the rent. She has never given anyone sex for money. She keeps telling herself that this night she won't do it. See what he does. Hell, if he leaves them, he leaves them. But then she lies there, waiting for Franny to go to sleep. Sometimes she knows Franny is awake when she crawls back. Franny never says anything, and unless the moon is up, it is usually too dark to see if her eyes are open. It is just one more weird thing. No weirder than walking up the highway, or getting off the highway in some small town and bartering with some old guy to take what is probably useless U.S. currency for well water. No weirder than no school. No weirder than no baths, no clothes, no nothing. Jane decides she's not going to do it the next night. But she knows she will lie there, anxious, and probably crawl over to Nate. They are walking one morning while the sky is still blue and darkening near the horizon. By midday, the sky will be white and the heat will be flattening. Franny asks Nate, "Have you ever been in love?" "God, Franny," Jane says. Nate laughs. "Maybe. Have you?" Franny looks irritable. "I'm in the 8th grade, she says. "And I'm not one of those girls with boobs, so I'm thinking no." Jane wants her to shut up, but Nate says, "What kind of guy would you fall in love with?" Franny looks a little sideways at him and then looks straight ahead. She has the most perfect skin, even after all this time in the sun. Skin like that is wasted on kids. Her look says, "Someone like you, stupid." "I don't know," Franny says. "Someone who knows how to do things? You know, when you need them." "What kind of things?" Nate asks. He's really interested. "Well, fuck. There's not a lot interesting on a freeway except other people walking in abandoned cars. They are passing a Sienna with a flat tire and all its doors open." Franny gestures toward it. "Like, fix a car. And I like him to be cute, too." Matter of fact. Serious as a church. Nate laughs. "Competent and cute." "Yeah," Franny says. "Competent and cute. Maybe you should be the one who knows how to fix a car," Jane says. "But I don't," Franny points out reasonably. "I mean, maybe someday I could learn, but right now I don't." "Maybe you'll meet someone in Canada," Nate says. "Canadian guys are supposed to be able to do things like fix a car, or fish, or hunt moose."
"Canadian guys are different than American guys?" Franny asks.
"Yeah," Nate says. "You know, all flannel shirts and Canadian beer and stuff."
"You wear a flannel shirt."
"I'd really like a Canadian beer about now," Nate says. "But I'm not Canadian."
Off the road to the right is a gas station convenience store. They almost always check them. There's not much likelihood of finding anything in the place because the wire fence that borders the highway has been trampled here so people can get over it, which suggests that the place has long since been looted. But you never know what someone might have left behind. Nate lopes off across the high grass.
"Mom," Franny says, Carry my backpack, okay?
She shrugs it off and runs. Amazing that she has the energy to run.
Jane picks up Franny's backpack, irritated, and follows. Nate and Franny disappear into the darkness inside.
She follows them in.
Franny, I'm not hauling your pack anymore.
There are some guys already in the place, and there is something about them, hard and well-fed, that signals they are different. Or maybe it is just the instincts of a prey animal and the presence of predators.
So, what's in that pack?
One of them asks. He's sitting on the counter at the cash register window, smoking a cigarette. She hasn't had a cigarette in weeks. Her whole body simultaneously leans toward the cigarette and yet magnifies everything in the room. A room full of men, all of them staring. She just keeps acting like nothing is wrong, because she doesn't know what else to do.
Dirty blankets, mostly, she says. I have to carry most of the crap.
One of the men is wearing a grimy hoodie. Hispanic yard workers do that sometimes. It must help in the sun. These men are all Anglos, and there are fewer of them than she first thought. 5. Two of them are sitting on the floor, their backs against an empty, dead ice cream cooler, their legs stretched out in front of them. Everyone on the road is dirty, but they are dirty and hard, physical. A couple of them grin. Feral flickers passing between them like glances. There is understanding in the room, shared purpose. She has the sense that she cannot let on that she senses anything, because the only thing holding them off is the pretense that everything is normal.
Not that we really need blankets in this weather, she says. I would kill for a functioning Holiday Inn.
Ha, the one by the cash register says. A bark, amused. Nate is carefully still. He is searching, eyes going from man to man. Franny looks as if she is about to cry. It is only a matter of time. They will be on her. Should she play up to the man at the cash register? If she tries to flirt, will it release the rising tension in the room? Allow them to spring on all of them? Will they kill Nate? What will they do to Franny? Or can she use her sex as currency? Go willingly. She does not feel as if they care if she goes willingly or not. They know there is nothing to stop them.
There's no beer here, is there? She says. She can hear her voice failing.
Nope, says the man sitting at the cash register.
What's your name? She asks.
It's the wrong thing to say. He slides off the counter. Most of the men are smiling now. Nate says,
Staff?
One of the guys on the floor looks up, his eyes narrow.
Nate says, Hey, Staff.
Hi, the guy says cautiously.
You remember me, Nate says. Nick, from the Blue Moon Inn.
Nothing. Staff's face is blank. But another guy, the one in the hoodie, says,
Speedy Nick.
Staff grins.
Speedy Nick! Fuck! Your hair's not blonde anymore.
Nate says, Yeah, well, you know, upkeep is tough on the road. He jerks a thumb at Jane. This is my sister, Janie, my niece, Franny. I'm taking them up to Toronto. There's supposed to be a place up there.
I heard about that, the guy in the hoodie says. Some kind of camp.
Ben, right? Nate says.
Yeah, the guy says.
The guy who was sitting on the counter is standing now, cigarettes still smoldering. He wants it. Doesn't want everybody to get all friendly. But the moment is shifting away from him.
We found some distilled water, Staff says. Tastes like shit, but you can have it if you want.
Jane doesn't ask him why he told her his name was Nate. For all she knows,
Nate is his name, and Nick is the lie.
They walk each day. Each night, she goes to his bedroll. She owes him.
Part of her wonders if maybe he's gay. Maybe he has to lie there and fantasize she's a guy or something. She doesn't know.
They are passing by water. They have some, so there's no reason to stop. There's an egret standing in the water, white as anything she has seen since this started, immaculately clean, oblivious to their passing, oblivious to the passing of everything. This is all good for the egrets. Jane hasn't had a drink since they started for Canada. She can't think of a time since she was 16 or so that she went so long without one. She wants to get dressed up and go out someplace and have a good time and not think about anything, because the bad thing about not having a drink is that she thinks all the time, and fuck, there's nothing in her life right now she really wants to think about. Especially not Canada, which she is deeply but silently certain is only a rumor. Not the country, she doesn't think it doesn't exist, but the camp. It is a mirage, a shimmer on the horizon, something to go toward, but which isn't really there. Or maybe they're the rumors, the three of them. Rumors of things gone wrong. At a rest stop in the middle of nowhere, they come across an encampment. A huge number of people, camped under tarps, pieces of plastic, and tatters, and astonishingly, a convoy of military trucks and jeeps, including a couple of fuel trucks and a couple of water trucks. Kids stop and watch as they walk in, then go back to chasing each other around the picnic tables. The two groups are clearly separate. The military men have control of all the asphalt and one end of the picnic area. They stand around or lounge at picnic tables. They look so equipped, from hats to combat boots. They look so clean. So much like the world Jane has put mostly out of her mind. They awaken her the longing that she has put down. The longing to be clean. To have walls, electric lights, plumbing, to have order. The rest look like refugees, the word she denied on the sidewalks outside the condo. Dirty people in t-shirts with bundles and plastic grocery bags and even a couple of suitcases. She has seen people like this as they walked past them sitting by the side of the road, sat by the side of the road as others walked past them. But to see them all together like this, this is what it will be like in Canada? A camp full of people with bags of wretched clothes waiting for someone to give them something to eat? A toddler with no pants and curly hair watches solemnly like one of those children in those Save a Child commercials. He's just as dirty. His hair is blonde. She rejects it. Rejects it all so viscerally that she stops and for a moment can't walk to the people in the rest stop. She doesn't know if she would have walked past, or if she would have turned around, or if she would have struck off across the country. It doesn't matter what she would have done, because Nate and Franny walk right on up the exit ramp. Franny's tank top is bright, insistent pink under its filth, and her shorts have a tear in them, and her legs are brown and skinny, and she could be a child on a news channel after a hurricane or an earthquake, clad in the loud synthetic colors so at odds with the dirt or ash that coats her. Plastic and synthetics are the indestructibles left to the survivors. Jane is ashamed. She wants to explain that she's not like this. She wants to say she's an American, by which she means she belongs to the military side, although she has never been interested in the military, never particularly liked soldiers. If she could call her parents in Pennsylvania, get a phone from one of the soldiers, surrender. You were right, Mom.
I should have straightened up and flown right. I should have worried more about school. I should have done it your way. I'm sorry. Can we come home? Would her parents still be there? Do the phones work just north of Philadelphia? It has not until this moment occurred to her that it is all gone. She sticks her fist in her mouth to keep from crying out, sick with understanding. It is all gone. She has thought herself all brave and realistic, getting Franny to Canada, but somehow she didn't until this moment realize that it all might be gone. That there might be nowhere for her where the electricity's still on and there are still carpets on the hardwood floors and someone still cares about Damask. Nate has finally noticed that she isn't with him, and he looks back, frowning at her. What's wrong? His expression says. She limps after them, defeated. Nate walks up to a group of people camped around and under a stone picnic table. Are they giving out water? He asks, meaning the military. Yeah, says a guy in a Cowboys football jersey. If you go ask, they'll give you water. Food? They say tonight. All the shade is taken. Nate takes their water bottles, a couple of 2 liters and a plastic gallon milk jug. You guys wait, and I'll get us some water, he says. Jane doesn't like being near these people, so she walks back to a wire fence at the back of the rest area and sits down. She puts her arms on her knees and puts her head down. She is looking at the grass. Mom, Franny says. Jane doesn't answer. Mom, are you okay? After a moment more, are you crying? I'm just tired, Jane says to the grass. Franny doesn't say anything after that. Nate comes back with all the bottles filled. Jane hears him coming and hears Franny say, oh, wow, I'm so thirsty. Nate nudges her arm with a bottle. Hey, babe, have some. She takes a 2-liter from him and drinks some. It's got a flat, faintly metal chemical taste. She gets a big drink and feels a little better. I'll be back, she says. She walks to the shelter where the bathrooms are. You don't want to go in there, a black man says to her. The whites of his eyes are yellow. She ignores him and pushes in the door. Inside, the smell is excruciating, and the sinks are all stopped up and full of trash. There is some light from the windows up near the ceiling. She looks at herself in the dim mirror. She pours a little water into her hand and scrubs at her face. There's a little bit of paper towel left on a roll, and she peels it off and cleans her face and her hands, using every bit of the scrap of paper towel. She wets her hair and combs her fingers through it, working the tangles for a long time until it is still curly, but not the rat's nest it was. She is so careful with the water. Even so, she uses every bit of it on her face and arms and hair. She would kill for a little lipstick, for a comb, anything. At least she has water. She is cute. The sun hasn't been too hard on her. She practices smiling. When she comes out of the bathroom, the air is so sweet. The sunlight is blinding. She walks over to the soldiers and smiles. Can I get some more water, please? There are 3 of them at the water truck. One of them is a blonde-haired boy with a brick-red complexion. You sure can, he says, smiling back at her. She stands, 1 foot thrust out in front of her like a ballerina, back a little arched. You're sweet, she says. Where are you from? We're all stationed at Fort Hood, he says, down in Texas. But we've been up north for a couple of months. How are things up north? She asks.
Crazy, he says. But not as crazy as they are in Texas, I guess.
She has no plan. She is just moving with the moment, drawn like a moth. He gets her water. All three of them are smiling at her.
How long are you here? She asks. Are you like a way station or something?
One of the others, a skinny Chicano, laughs.
Oh no, we're here tonight and then headed west.
I used to live in California, she says. In Pasadena, where the Rose Parade is. I used to walk down that street where the cameras are every day. The blonde glances around.
Look, we aren't supposed to be talking too much right now. But later on, when it gets dark, you should come back over here and talk to us some more.
Mom, Franny says when she gets back to the fence, you're all cleaned up.
Nice, babe, Nate says. He's frowning a little.
Can I get cleaned up? Franny asks.
The bathroom smells really bad, Jane says. I don't think you want to go in there.
But she digs her other t-shirt out of her backpack and wets it and washes Franny's face. The girl is never going to be pretty. But now that she's not chubby, she's got a cute thing going on. She's got the sense to work it. Or we'll learn it.
You're a girl that the boys are going to look at, Jane says to her.
Franny smiles, delighted.
Don't you think? Jane says to Nate. She's got that thing. That sparkle, doesn't she?
She sure does, Nate says. They nap in the grass until the sun starts to go down, and then the soldiers line everyone up and hand out MREs. Nate gets beef ravioli, and Jane gets sloppy Joe. Franny gets lemon pepper tuna and looks ready to cry, but Jane offers to trade with her. The meals are positive cornucopias. A side dish, a little packet of candy, peanut butter and crackers, fruit punch powder. Everybody has different things, and Jane makes everybody give everyone else a taste. Nate keeps looking at her oddly.
You're in a great mood.
It's like a party, she says. Jane and Franny are really pleased by the moist towelette. Franny carefully saves her plastic fork, knife, and spoon.
Was your tuna okay? She asks.
She is feeling guilty now that the food is gone.
It was good, Jane says.
And all the other stuff made it really special. And I got the best dessert. The night comes down. Before they got on the road, Jane didn't know how dark night was. Without electric lights, it is cripplingly dark. But the soldiers have lights.
Jane says, I'm going to go see if I can find out about the camp.
I'll go with you, Nate says.
No, Jane says. They talk to a girl more than they'll talk to a guy. You keep Franny company. She scouts around the edge of the light until she sees the blonde soldier. He says,
there you are.
Here I am, she says.
They are standing around a truck where they'll sleep this night, shooting the shit. The blonde soldier boosts her into the truck, into the darkness.
So you aren't so conspicuous, he says, grinning.
Two of the men standing and talking aren't wearing uniforms. It takes her a while to figure out that they're civilian contractors. They aren't soldiers. They are technicians, nothing like the soldiers. They are softer, easier in their polo shirts and khaki pants. The soldiers are too sure in their uniforms. But the contractors, they're used to getting the leftovers. They're grateful. They have a truck of their own, a white pickup truck that travels with the convoy. They do something with satellite tracking, but Jane doesn't really care what they do. It takes a lot of careful maneuvering, but one of them finally whispers to her,
we've got some beer in our truck.
The blonde soldier looks hurt by her defection. She stays out of sight in the morning, Crouched among the equipment in the back of the pickup truck, the soldiers hand out MREs. Ted, one of the contractors, smuggles her one. She thinks of Franny. Nate will keep an eye on her. Jane was only a year older than Franny when she lit out for California the first time. For a second, she pictures Franny's face as the convoy pulls out. Then she doesn't think of Franny. She doesn't know where she is going. She is in motion.